Chapter 23. Later that day, Geryon rode out to continue his observation of the ongoing siege of the town of Rehon. He found Barak, Mandaralan, and Durnik in the midst of a discussion.
"It has to do with the way the walls are built, Mandaralan," Durnik was trying to explain. "A city wall is put together to withstand exactly what you're trying to do to that one."
Mandaralan shrugged.
"It becomes a test, then. A test, good man, to discover which is the stronger, their walls or mine engines."
"That's a kind of test that could take months, then," Durnik pointed out.
"But if instead of throwing rocks at the outside of the wall, you lob them all the way over to hit the inside of the wall on the far side, you'd stand a pretty fair chance of toppling them outward."
Mandaralan frowned, mulling it over in his mind.
"It could be right, Mandaralan," Barak added. "City walls are usually buttressed from the inside. They're built to keep the people out, not in. If you bang rocks against the inside of the walls, you won't have the strength of the buttresses to contend with. Not only that, if the walls fall outward, they'll provide us with the natural ramp into the city. That way we won't need scaling ladders."
Yarblick sauntered over to join the discussion, his fur cap at a jaunty angle. After Durnik had explained his idea, the rangy-looking Nadrak's eyes narrowed thoughtfully.
"He's got a point, Erend," he said to Mandaralan. "And after you have pounded the walls from the inside for a while, we can throw a few grappling hooks over the top of them. If the walls have already been weakened, we should be able to pull them down."
"I must admit the feasibility of these most unorthodox approaches to the art of the siege," Mandaralan said. "Though they both do fly in the face of long-established tradition, they show promise of shortening the tedious procedure of reducing the walls."
He looked curiously at Yarblick.
"I had not previously considered this notion of using grappling hooks just so."
Yarblick laughed coarsely.
"Yes, probably because you are not a Nadrak. We are an impatient people, so we don't build very good walls. I have put down some pretty stout-looking houses in my time, for one reason or another."
"I think, though, that we don't want to yank down the walls too soon," Barak cautioned. "The people inside outnumber us just now, and we don't want to give them any reason to come swarming out of that place. If you pull a man's walls down, it usually makes him very grouchy."
The siege of Rehon continued for 2 more days before Javelin returned astride an exhausted horse.
"How does put his own people in most of the positions of authority in the army," he reported, once they had all gathered in the large dun-colored tent serving as the headquarters of the besieging army. "We're going all around making speeches about Belgarion taking Queen Porin prisoner. They've about halfway persuaded the troops that they're coming to her rescue."
"Was there any sign of Brendig and the Sendars yet?" Geryon asked.
"I didn't see them personally, but Haldar has 6 troops moving at a forced march, and he's got a lot of scouts out behind him. I think he believes that Brendig's right on his heels. On the way back, I ran into Lady Pulgara and the Sorcerer Belden. They seem to be planning something, but I did not have the time to get any details."
He slumped in his chair with a look of exhaustion on his face.
"You are tired, Kenden," Queen Porin said. "Why don't you get a few hours' sleep, and we'll gather here again this evening?" "I am all right, Your Majesty," he said quickly. "Go to bed, Javelin. Your contributions to our discussions won't be very coherent if you keep falling asleep in your chair."
"You might as well do as she says, Javelin," Silk advised. "She's going to mother you, whether you like it or not."
"That will do, Silk," Porin said.
Oh, but you will, Auntie. You're known far and wide as the little mother of Thrasnia. I said that will do. Yes, Mother.
I think you're walking on very thin ice, Silk,
Yarblick said. Oh, I always walk on thin ice. It gives my life a certain zest.
The gloomy days were slowly settling into an even gloomier evening as Geryon and his friends gathered once more in the large tent near the center of the encampment. Yarblick had brought a number of rolled-up rugs with him and several iron braziers, and these contributions to their headquarters added certain garish, even barbaric touches to the interior of the tent.
"Where is Silk?" Geryon asked, looking around as they all seated themselves around the glowing braziers.
"I think he's out snooping," Beric replied.
Geryon made a face. "I wish that just once he'd be where he's supposed to be."
Javelin looked much more alert after his few hours of sleep. His expression, however, was grave.
"We're starting to run out of time," he told them. "We've got three armies converging on this place. Lord Hetar is coming up from the south, and General Brendig is coming in from the west. Unfortunately, the Dresnian pikemen are very likely to get here first."
"Unless Paul and Belden can slow them down," Durnick added.
"I have every confidence in Lady Polgra and Master Belden,"
Javelin said.
"But I think we should decide what we are going to do in the event that they are not successful. It is always best to prepare for the worst."
"Wisely spoken, my lord," Mandarallan murmured.
"Now," the chief of Dresnian intelligence continued, "we don't truly want to fight the pikemen. First of all, they are not really our enemies. Secondly, a battle with them is going to weaken our forces to the point that a sortie in force from the city could conceivably defeat us."
"What are you leading up to, Javelin?"
Poran asked.
"I think we're going to have to get into the city."
"We haven't got enough men," Beric said flatly.
"And we'll take several more days to reduce these walls,"
Mandarallan added.
Javelin held up one hand.
"If we concentrate the siege engines on one section of wall, we should be able to bring it down within one day."
"But that just announces which quarter that we will attack from,"
Lelderin protested.
"The forces in the city will be concentrated there to repel us."
"Not if the city is on fire,"
Javelin replied.
"Absolutely out of the question," Geryon said. "My son could be in that town. I'm not going to risk his life by setting the whole place on fire."
"I still say that we haven't got enough men to take the city."
"We don't have to take the whole city, my lord of Thralheim. All we need to do is to get our men inside. If we take one quarter of the town and fortify it, we can hold off the cult from the inside and Haldar from the outside. Then we simply sit tight and wait for Lord Hetar and General Brendig."
"It's got some possibilities," Yarblick said. "The way things stand right now, we are caught in the Nutcracker. If those pikemen get here first, about all your friends are going to be able to do when they arrive is to pick up the pieces."
"No fire," Geryon declared adamantly.
"I do fear me that however we proceed, we may not gain entry into the city ere the walls are breached,"
Mandarallan observed.
"The walls aren't really any problem," Durnick said quietly. "No wall's any better than its foundation." "It is quite impossible, good man," Mandarallan told him. "A wall's foundation hath the entire weight resting upon it. No engine in the world can move such a mass."
"I wasn't talking about an engine," Durnick said.
"What have you got in mind, Durnick?"
"It's not really going to be that hard, Geryon," Durnick said. "I did a bit of looking around.
Laws aren't resting on rock. They're resting on packed dirt. All we've got to do is soften that dirt a bit. There's plenty of underground water in this region. If we put our heads together, you and I ought to be able to bring it up under one section of the wall without anyone inside the city knowing what we've done. Once the ground is soft enough, a few dozen of Yarblek's grappling hooks ought to be enough to topple it.
Can it be done, Geryon?
Lothoran asked doubtfully. Geryon thought it through.
Well,
it's possible. It's very possible.
And if we did it at night, we could be in position to rush into the city just as soon as the wall falls. We could get inside without losing a single man.
It is a novel solution, Silk observed from the doorway of the tent. A little unethical, perhaps, but novel all the same.
Where have you been, you little sneak?
Yarblek demanded.
In Rayon, actually.
You were inside the city?
Barak asked in surprise. Silk shrugged. Of course. I thought it might be appropriate to get a friend of ours out of there before we took the place apart. He stepped aside with a mocking little bow to admit the honey-blonde Margravine Lazelle.
Now that is a splendid-looking young woman,
Yarblek breathed in admiration. Lazelle smiled at him, the dimples dancing in her cheeks.
How did you get inside?
Geryon asked the rat-faced little man.
You really wouldn't want to know, Geryon,
Silk told him.
There is always a way in or out of a city, if you're really serious about it.
You two don't smell too good,
Yarblek noted.
It has to do with the route we took,
Lazelle replied, wrinkling her nose.
You're looking well,
Javelin said conversationally to his niece.
Are things considered? Thank you, Uncle,
she replied. Then she turned to Geryon.
Are the rumors going about the city true, Your Majesty? Has your son been abducted?
Geryon nodded grimly. It happened just after we took Jarvixholm. That's why we're here.
But Prince Geryon does not seem to be in Rayon,
she told him.
Are you sure?
Synedra demanded.
I think so, Your Majesty. The cultists inside the city are baffled. They seem to have no idea of who took your son.
Ulfgar may be keeping it secret,
Javelin said.
Only a small group may know.
Perhaps, but it does not look that way. I was not able to get close enough to him to make sure, but he has the look of a man whose plans have gone all awry. I don't think he expected this attack on Rayon. His fortifications are not nearly as complete as they might appear from the outside. The north wall in particular is rather flimsy. His reinforcements of the walls seem a desperation move. He was not expecting a siege. If he had been behind the abduction, he would have been prepared for the attack, unless he thought you could never trace it to him.
This is most excellent news, my lady,
Mandarallan praised her.
Since we know of the weakness of the northern fortifications, we can concentrate our efforts there. If Goodman Durnick's plan proves workable, a weakening of the foundations of the north wall should bring it down most speedily.
What can you tell us about Ulfgar? Beric asked.
I only saw him briefly at a distance. He spends most of his time inside his house, and only his closest cohorts are allowed near him. He made a speech, though, just before he sent his forces to attack you. He speaks very passionately, and he had the crowd absolutely under his control. I can tell you one thing about him, though. He is not an Alorn.
He's not?
Beric looked dumbfounded.
His face does not give away his nationality, but his speech is not that of an Alorn.
Why would the cult accept an outsider as their leader? Geryon demanded.
They are not aware of the fact that he is an outsider. He mispronounces a few words, just a couple, actually, and only a trained ear would catch them. If I had been able to get closer to him, I might have been able to steer him toward those words that would have betrayed his origins. I am sorry that I can't be more of help.
How strong is his grip on the cult? Javelin asked.
It is absolute, she replied. They will do anything he tells them to do. They look upon him as something very akin to a god.
We're going to have to take him alive, Garion said grimly. I have to have some answers.
That may be extremely difficult, Your Majesty. It is widely believed in Rohan that he is a sorcerer. I did not actually see any evidence of it myself, but I talked with a number of people who have, or at least who claimed they have done so. You have performed a great service for us, Margravine,
Queen Porin said gratefully.
It shall not be forgotten. Thank you, Your Majesty,
Isel replied simply, with a formal little curtsy. Then she turned back to Garion.
What information I was able to glean says quite strongly that the cult forces within the walls are not nearly so formidable as we were led to believe. Their numbers are impressive, but they include a great many young boys and old men. They appear to be counting rather desperately on a force that is marching toward the city under the command of a hidden cult member.
Haldar, Beric said.
She nodded.
And that brings us right back to the absolute necessity of getting inside those walls, Javelin told them.
He looked at Durnik.
How long do you estimate that it's going to take for the ground under the north wall to soften enough to topple the structure?
Durnik sat back, staring thoughtfully at the ceiling of the tent.
We want to take them by surprise, so I don't think we want the water to come gushing out, not at first anyway. A gradual seepage would be far less noticeable. It's going to take a while to saturate the ground.
And we are going to have to be very careful, Garion added. If this Ulfgar really is a sorcerer, he will hear us if we make too much noise.
There will be plenty of noise when the wall comes down, Beric said. Why don't you just blow it apart the way you did the back wall of Jarvik'sholm?
Garion shook his head. There are a couple of moments after you unleash your will when you are absolutely vulnerable to attack by anybody who has the same kind of talent, Garion said. I would sort of like to be alive and sane when I find my son.
How long would it take you to soak the ground under the wall? Javelin asked.
Durnik scratched at his cheek.
Tonight, he replied, and all day tomorrow. By mid-morning tomorrow, the wall ought to be sufficiently undermined. Then, just before we attack, Garion and I can speed up the flow of water and wash out most of the dirt. It's going to be very wet and soft already, and a good stream of water ought to cut it right out from under the wall. If we lob stones at it from the far side and get a few dozen grappling hooks into it, we should be able to pull it down in short order.
You might want to pick up the pace with your engines, Yarblek said to Mandarallan. Give them time to get used to the idea of rocks coming out of the sky. That way they won't pay any attention when you start pounding on their walls tomorrow night.
Midnight tomorrow, then, Beric said.
Right, Garion said firmly. Javelin looked at his niece.
Do you have the layout of the north quarter of the city fairly well in mind?
She nodded.
Make a sketch for us. We'll need to know where to set up our defenses once we get inside.
Right after I bathe, Uncle.
We need that sketch, Lizelle.
Not nearly as badly as I need a bath. You too, Keldar,
Queen Porin said firmly. Sulk gave Lysel a speculative look.
Never mind, Keldar. I can wash my own back, thank you.
Let's go find some water, Durnik, Garion said, getting to his feet. Underground, I mean.
Right, the smith replied.
There was no moon, of course. The clouds that had covered the area for the past week and more obscured the sky. The night air was chill as Garion and Durnik moved carefully across the shallow valley toward the besieged city.
Cold night, Durnik murmured as they walked through the rank gorse.
Mm-hmm, Garion agreed.
How deep do you think the water might be lying?
Not too deep.
I asked Lysel how deep the wells are in Rayon. She said that they were all fairly shallow. I think we'll hit water about 25 feet.
What gave you this idea, anyway?
Dernick chuckled softly in the darkness.
When I was much younger, I worked for a farmer who gave himself great airs. He thought it might impress his neighbors if he had a well right inside his house. We worked at it all one winter and finally tapped into an artesian flow. 3 days later, his house collapsed. Oh, he was very upset about it.
I can imagine.
Dernick looked up at the looming walls.
I don't know that we need to get any closer. It might be hard to concentrate if they see us and start shooting arrows at us. Let's work around to the north side.
Right.
They moved in more carefully now, trying to avoid making any sound in the rustling gorse.
Well, this should do it here, Dernick whispered. Let's see what's down there.
Geryon let his thoughts sink quietly down through the hard-packed earth under the north wall of the city. The first few feet were very difficult, since he kept encountering moles and earthworms. An angry chittering told him that he had briefly disturbed a badger. Then he hit a layer of rock and probed his thought along its flat surface, looking for fissures.
"It's just your left," Dernick murmured. "Isn't that a crack?"
Geryon found it and wormed his way downward. The fissure seemed to grow damper and damper the deeper he went.
"It's wet down there," he whispered. "But the crack's so narrow that the water's barely seeping up."
"Well, it's wide in the crack. Not too much, just enough to let a trickle come up."
Geryon bent his will and felt Dernick's will joining with his. Together they shouldered the crack in the rock a bit wider. The water lying beneath the rock layer gushed upward. Together they pulled back and felt the water begin to erode the hard-packed dirt under the wall, seeping and spreading in the darkness beneath the surface.
"Let's move on, then," Dernick whispered. "We ought to open up 6 or 8 places under the wall in order to soak the ground thoroughly. Then tomorrow night we can push the cracks wide open."
Geryon asked, "Won't that wash out this whole hillside?"
Probably.
"Well, that's going to make it a little hard for our troops when they rush in this place."
"There's not much question about the fact that they're going to get their feet wet," Dernick said. "Well, that's better than trying to scale a wall with somebody pouring boiling oil on your head, wouldn't you say?"
"Much better,"
Geryon agreed. They moved on through the chill night. Then something brushed Geryon's cheek. At first he ignored it, but it came again, soft and cold and damp. His heart sank.
"Dernick," he whispered, "it's starting to snow."
"Oh, I thought that's what it was. I think this is going to turn very unpleasant on us."
The snow continued to fall through the remainder of the night and on into the next morning. Though there were occasional flurries that swirled around the bleak fortress, the snowfall, for the most part, was intermittent. It was a wet, sodden kind of snow that turned to slush almost as soon as it touched the ground. Shortly before noon, Geryon and Lalderin donned heavy work cloaks and stout boots and went out into the snow-clogged encampment toward the north wall of Rayon. When they were perhaps 200 paces from the base of the hill upon which the city rested, they sauntered along with a great show of casualness, trying to look like nothing more dangerous than a pair of soldiers on patrol. As Geryon looked at the fortress city, he saw the red and black bear flag once more, and once again that banner raised an irrational rage in him.
"Are you sure that you will be able to recognize your arrows in the dark?"
he asked his friend.
"There are a lot of arrows sticking in the ground out there, you know."
Lalderin drew his bow and shot an arrow in a long arc toward the city. The feathered shaft rose high in the air and then dropped to sink into the snow-covered turf about 50 paces from the beginning of the slope.
"I made the arrows myself, Geryon," he said, taking another shaft from the quiver at his back. "Believe me, I can recognize one of them as soon as my fingers touch it."
He leaned back and bent his bow again.
"Is the ground getting soft under the wall?"
Geryon sent out his thought toward the slope of the hill and felt the chill, musty dampness of the soil lying under the snow.
Slowly,
he replied.
It's still pretty firm, though.
It is almost noon, Geryon,
Lelderin said seriously, reaching for another arrow.
I know how thoroughly good man Durnik thinks things through, but is this really working?
It takes a while,
Geryon told him.
You have to soak the lower layers of earth first. Then the water starts to rise and saturate the dirt directly under the wall itself. It takes time, but if the water started gushing out of rabbit holes, the people on top of the wall would know that something's wrong.
Think of how the rabbits would feel,
Lelderin grinned and shot another arrow. They moved on as Lelderin continued to mark the jumping-off line of the coming night's assault with deceptive casualness.
All right, Geryon said. I know that you can recognize your own arrows, but how about the rest of us? One arrow feels just like another to me.
Ah, simple, the young bowman replied. I just creep up, find my arrows, and string them all together with twine. When you hit that string, you stop and wait for the wall to topple. Then you charge. We've been making night assaults on Mimbrate houses in Astoria for centuries this way.
Throughout the remainder of that snowy day, Geryon and Durnik periodically checked the level of moisture in the soil of the north slope of the steep knoll upon which the city of Rayon stood.
It's getting very close to the saturation point, Geryon, Durnik reported as dusk began to fall. There's a few places on the lower slope where the water's starting to seep through the snow.
It's a good thing it's getting dark,
Geryon said, shifting the weight of his mail shirt nervously. Armor of any kind always made him uncomfortable, and the prospect of the upcoming assault on the city filled him with a peculiar emotion, part anxiety and part anticipation. Durnik, his oldest friend, looked at him with an understanding that pierced any possible concealment. He grinned a bit wryly.
What's up? Pair of sensible Sindarin farm boys doing fighting a war in the snow in eastern Drasnia,
he asked. Winning, I hope, answered Geryon.
Oh, we'll win, Geryon,
Durnik assured him, laying an affectionate hand on the younger man's shoulder.
Sindars always win, eventually.
About an hour after midnight, Mandarallan began to move his siege engines, leaving only enough of them on the eastern and western sides to continue the intermittent barrage that was to mask their real purpose. As the hour wore on, Geryon, Lelderin, Durnik, and Silk crept forward at a half-crouch toward the invisible line of arrows sticking up out of the snow.
"Here's one,"
Durnik whispered, as his outstretched hands encountered the shaft of an arrow.
"Here,"
Lelderin murmured.
"Let me feel it."
He joined the smith, both of them on their knees in the slush.
"Yes, it is one of mine, Geryon,"
he said very quietly.
"They should be about 10 paces apart."
Silk moved quickly to where the two of them crouched over the arrow.
"Show me how you recognize them," he breathed.
"It's in the fletching,"
Lelderin replied.
"I always use twisty gut to attach the feathers."
Silk felt the feathered end of the arrow.
"All right, I can pick them out now."
"Are you sure?"
Lelderin asked.
"If my fingertips can find the spots on a pair of dice, they can certainly tell the difference between gut and linen twine," Silk replied.
"All right, we'll start here."
Lelderin attached one end of a ball of twine to the arrow.
"I will go this way and you go that."
"Right." Silk tied the end of his ball of string to the same shaft. He turned to Geryon and Durnik.
"Don't overdo it with the water, you two. I don't particularly want to get buried in a mudslide out here."
Then he moved off, crouching low and groping for the next arrow. Lelderin touched Geryon's shoulder briefly, then disappeared in the opposite direction.
"Ground's completely soaked now," Durnik murmured.
"If we open those fissures about a foot wide, it's going to flush most of the support out from under the wall."
"Good."
Again they sent their probing thoughts out through the sodden earth of the hillside. Locating the layer of rock, and then sweeping back and forth along its irregular upper side until they located the first fissure. Garion felt a peculiar sensation as he began to worm his thought down that narrow crack where the water came welling up from far below. Almost as if he were extending some incredibly long, though invisible, arm with slender, supple fingers at its end to reach down into the crack.
"Have you got it?"
he whispered to Durnick.
"Oh, I think so."
"Well, let's pull it apart, then,"
Garion said, bracing his will. Slowly, with an effort that made the beads of sweat stand out on their foreheads, the two of them forced the fissure open. A sharp, muffled crack reverberated up from beneath the sodden slope of the hillside as the rock broke under the force of their combined wills.
"Who's there?"
a voice demanded from atop the city wall.
"Is it open wide enough?"
Garion whispered, ignoring that alarmed challenge.
"The water's coming up much faster,"
Durnick replied after a moment's probing.
"There's a lot of pressure under that layer of rock. Let's move on to the next place."
A heavy twang came from somewhere behind them, and a peculiar slithering whistle passed overhead as the line from one of Yarblek's catapult-launched grappling hooks arched up and over the north wall. The hook made a steely clink as it slapped against the inside of the wall, and then there was a grating sound as the points dug in. Crouched low, Garion and Durnick moved carefully on to their left, trying to minimize the soggy, squelching sound their feet made in the slush while probing beneath the earth for the next fissure. When Laldoran came back to rejoin them, they had already opened two more of those hidden cracks lying beneath that saturated slope. Behind and above them, there was a gurgling sound as the soupy mud oozed out of the hillside to cascade in a brown flood down the snowy slope.
"I got all the way to the end of the line of arrows,"
Laldoran reported.
"The string is in place on this side."
"Good," Garion said, panting slightly from his exertions.
"Go back and tell Barak to start moving the troops into place."
"Right."
Laldoran turned and went off into the swirl of a sudden snow flurry.
"We'll have to be careful with this one,"
Durnick murmured, searching along under the soil.
"There's a lot of fissures in the rock, eh? We pull it too far apart, we'll break up the whole layer and turn loose a river."
Garion grunted his agreement as he sent the probing fingers of his will out toward the fissure. When they reached the last of their subterranean wellsprings, Silk came out of the dark behind them, his nimble feet making no sound as he moved through the slush.
"Oh, what kept you?" Durnick whispered to the little man. "You only had about 100 yards to go."
"I was checking the slope," Silk replied. "The whole thing is starting to ooze through the snow like cold gravy." And then I went up and pushed my foot against one of the foundation stones of the wall. It wobbled like a loose tooth.
"Well," Durnick said, in a tone of self-satisfaction, "it worked after all."
There was a pause in the snowy darkness.
"You mean you weren't actually sure?" Silk asked in a strangled voice.
"A theory was sound,"
the smith answered in an offhand sort of way.
"But you can never be actually positive about a theory until you try it."
"Durnick, I am getting too old for this."
Another grappling hook sailed overhead.
"We've got one more to open," Garion murmured. "Barak's moving the troops into place. Do you want to go back and tell Yarblek to send up the signal to Mandarallan?"
"Oh, it'll be my pleasure," Silk replied. "I want to get out of here before we are all hip-deep in mud anyway."
He turned and went off into the dark. Perhaps 10 minutes later, when the last fissure had been opened and the entire north slope of the hill had turned into a slithering mass of oozing mud and freely running water, an orange ball of blazing pitch arched high in the air over the city. In response to that prearranged signal, Mandarallan's engines, emplaced to the south, began a continuous barrage, lofting their heavy stones high above the rooftops of Rayon to slam against the inside of the north wall. At that same time, the lines of Yarblek's grappling hooks tautened as the Nadrak mercenaries began to move their teams of horses away from the wall. There was an ominous creaking and grinding along the top of the hill as the weakened wall began to sway.
"How much longer do you think it's going to stand?"
Barak asked as he came out of the darkness with Lalderan at his side to join them.
"Not very,"
Durnik replied.
"Ground's starting to give way under it."
The groaning creak above them grew louder, punctuated by the continual sharp crashes along the inside as Mandoralan's catapults stepped up the pace of their deadly rain. Then, with a sound like an avalanche, a section of the wall collapsed with a peculiar sinuous motion as the upper portion toppled outward and the lower sank into the sodden earth. There was a great splashing rumble as the heavy stones cascaded into the slush and mud of the hillside.
"Man should never try to put up stonework, resting only on dirt,"
Durnik observed critically.
"Under the circumstances, I'm glad they did," Barak told him.
"Well, yes," Durnik admitted.
"But there are right ways to do things."
The big Kerak chuckled.
"Durnik, you are an absolute treasure, do you know that?"
Another section of the wall toppled outward to splash onto the slope. Shouts of alarm and the clanging of bells began to echo through the streets of the fortified town.
"You want me to move the men out?"
Barak asked Geryon, his voice tensing with excitement.
"Let's wait until the whole wall comes down," Geryon replied. "I don't want them charging up the hill with all of those building stones falling on them."
"There it goes,"
Lelderin laughed gleefully, pointing toward the last toppling section of the wall.
"Start them in," Geryon said tersely, reaching over his shoulder for the great sword strapped to his back.
Barak drew a deep breath.
"Charge!"
he roared in a vast voice. With a concerted shout, the Rivens and their Nadrak allies plunged up through the slush and mud and began clambering over the fallen ruins of the north wall and on into the city.
"Let's go," Barak shouted. "We'll miss all the fighting if we don't hurry."
Chapter 24. The fight was short, and in many cases very ugly. Each element of Geryon's army had been thoroughly briefed by Javelin and his niece, and they had all been given specific assignments. Unerringly, they moved through the snowy firelit streets to occupy designated houses. Other elements, angling in from the edges of the breach in the north wall, circled the defensive perimeter that Javelin had drawn on Lazelle's map to pull down the houses and fill the streets with obstructing rubble. The first counterattack came just before dawn. Howling bear cultists clad in shaggy furs swarmed out of the narrow streets beyond the perimeter to swarm up over the rubble of the collapsed houses, only to run directly into a withering rain of arrows from the rooftops and upper windows. After dreadful losses, they fell back. As dawn broke pale and gray along the snowy eastern horizon, the last few pockets of resistance inside the perimeter crumbled, and the north quarter of Rayon was secure. Geryon stood somberly at a broken upper window of a house overlooking the cleared area that marked the outer limits of the part of town that was now under his control. The bodies of the cultists who had mounted the counterattack lay sprawled in twisted and grotesque heaps, already lightly dusted with the falling snow.
"Not a bad little fight," Barak declared, coming into the room with his blood-stained sword still in his hand.
He dropped his dented shield in a corner and came over to the window.
"I didn't care much for it," Geryon replied, pointing at the windrows of the dead lying below. "Killing people is a very poor way of changing their minds."
"They started this war, Geryon. You didn't."
"No," Geryon corrected. "Ulfgar started it. He's the one I actually want."
Then we'll have to go and get him for you, Beric said, carefully wiping his sword with a bit of tattered cloth. During the course of the day, there were several more furious counterattacks from inside the city, but the results were much the same as had been the case with the first. Geryon's positions were too secure and too well covered by archers to fall to these sporadic sorties.
They don't actually fight well in groups, do they?
Durnick said from the vantage point of the upper story of that half-ruined house.
They don't have that kind of discipline, Silk replied.
The little man was sprawled on a broken couch in one corner of the room, carefully peeling an apple with a small, sharp knife.
Individually, they're as brave as lions, but the concept of unified action hasn't quite seeped into their heads yet.
That was an awfully good shot, Beric congratulated Lalduran, who had just loosed an arrow through the shattered window.
Lalduran shrugged.
It is child's play. Now that fellow creeping along the roofline of the house several streets back, that is a bit more challenging.
He knocked another arrow, drew, and released all in one smooth motion.
You got him, Beric said.
Naturally.
As evening approached, Polgra and Belden returned to the camp outside the city.
Well, the gnarled sorcerer said with a certain satisfaction, you won't have to worry about the pikemen for a while.
He held out his twisted hands to one of Yarblick's glowing braziers.
You didn't hurt them, did you? Boran asked quickly.
No, he grinned. We just bogged them down. They were going through a marshy valley, and we diverted a river into it. The whole place is a quagmire now. They're perched on hummocks and in the branches of trees, waiting for the water to subside.
Won't that stall Brendig as well? Brendig is marching around the valley,
Polgara assured him, sitting near one of the braziers with a cup of tea.
He should be here in a few days.
She looked at Vela.
This tea is really excellent, she said.
Thank you, Lady Polgra,
the dark-haired dancer replied. Her eyes were fixed on Zenedra's copper curls, radiant in the golden candlelight. She sighed enviously.
If I had hair like that, Yarblek could sell me for double the price.
I would settle for half, Yarblek muttered, just to avoid all those incidental knifings.
Don't be such a baby, Yarblek, she told him.
I didn't really hurt you all that much.
You aren't the man who is doing the bleeding. Have you been practicing your curses, Vela?
Belden asked. She demonstrated, at some length.
Ah, you're getting better, he congratulated her.
For the next 2 days, Geryon's forces worked to heap obstructions along the rubble-choked perimeter of the north quarter of Rayon. This was to prevent a counterattack in force from crossing that intervening space. Geryon and his friends observed the process from a large window high up in the house which they had converted into their headquarters.
Whoever is in charge over there doesn't seem to have a very good grasp of basic strategy, Yarblek noted. He is not making any effort to block off his side of that open space, to keep us out of the rest of the city.
Beric frowned.
You know something, Yarblek. You're right. That should have been his first move after we secured this part of the town.
Maybe he is too arrogant to believe that we can take more of his houses,
Lalduran suggested.
Either that, or he's laying traps for us back out of sight,
Durnick added.
That's possible too, Beric agreed. More than possible. Maybe we ought to do a little planning before we start any more attacks.
Before we can plan anything, we have to know exactly what kind of traps Ulfgar has waiting for us,
Javelin said. Silk sighed and made a wry face. All right. After dark, I'll go have a look.
I wasn't really suggesting that, Keldar.
Of course you weren't.
It is a very good idea, though. I am glad that you thought of it.
It was some time after midnight when Silk returned to the large firelit room in Geryon's headquarters. "It's a very unpleasant night out there," the little man said, shivering and rubbing his hands together. He went over to stand in front of the fire.
"Well, are they planning any surprises for us?"
Beric asked while lifting a copper tankard.
"Oh, yes. They're building walls across the street several houses back from our perimeter, and they're putting them just around corners, so you won't see them until you're right on top of them."
"With archers and tubs of boiling pitch in all of the houses nearby?"
Beric asked glumly.
"Probably," Silk shrugged. "Do you have any more of that ale? I am chilled to the bone." "We'll have to work on this a bit," Javelin mused.
"Good luck," Beric said sourly, going to the ale keg. "I hate fighting in towns. Give me a nice open field any time."
"But the towns are where all of the loot is,"
Yarblek said.
"Is that all you ever think about?"
"We are in this life to make a profit, my friend,"
the raw-boned Nadrak replied with a shrug.
"You sound just like Silk."
"I know. That is why we went into a partnership."
It continued to snow lightly throughout the following day. The citizens of Raihan made a few more probing attacks on Geryon's defensive perimeter, but for the most part they contented themselves with merely shooting arrows at anything that moved. About mid-morning the next day, Erend picked his way over the rubble of the fallen north wall and went directly to the house from which Geryon was directing operations. When he entered, his young face was light with exhilaration, and he was panting noticeably.
"That's exciting," he said.
"What is?" Geryon asked him.
"Dodging arrows."
"Does Aunt Paul know you're here?"
"I don't think so. I wanted to see the city, so I just came."
"You're going to get us both in trouble, do you know that?"
Erend shrugged. "A scolding doesn't hurt all that much. Oh, I thought you ought to know that Hetar's here, or he will be, in an hour or so. He's just a few miles to the south."
"Finally," Geryon said with an explosive release of his breath.
"How did you find out?" "Horse and I went for a ride. He gets restless when he's pinned up. Anyway, we were up on that big hill to the south, and I saw the Algars coming."
"Well, let's go meet them."
"Why don't we?"
When Geryon and his young friend reached the top of the hill south of Raihan, they saw wave upon wave of Algar clansmen flowing over the snowy moors at a brisk canter. A single horseman detached himself from the front rank of that sea of horses and men and pounded up the hill, his long black scalp lock flowing out behind him.
"Good morning, Geryon,"
Hetar said casually as he reined in.
"You have been well, I trust."
"Moderately," Geryon grinned at him.
"You have got snow up here."
Geryon looked around in feigned astonishment. "Why, I do believe you're right. I hadn't even noticed that." Another rider came up the hill, a man in a shabby hooded cloak.
"Where is your aunt, Geryon?"
the man called when he was halfway up the hill.
"Grandfather?"
Geryon exclaimed with surprise.
"I thought you were going to Mar Terran."
Belgarath made an indelicate sound.
"I did," he replied as he reined in his horse. "And it was an absolutely wasted trip. I'll tell you about it later. What has been going on here?"
Briefly, Geryon filled them in on the events of the past several weeks.
"You have been busy,"
Hetar noted.
"The time goes faster when you keep occupied."
"Is Paul inside the city, then?"
Belgarath asked him.
"No. She and Synedra and the other ladies are staying in the camp we built when we first got here. The cultists have been counterattacking against our positions inside, so I didn't think it was entirely safe for them to be in there."
Makes sense. Why don't you round up everybody and bring them to the camp? I think we need to talk about a few things."
"All right, Grandfather."
It was shortly after noon when they gathered in the main tent in the Riven encampment outside the city.
Were you able to find anything useful, father?
Bolgara asked Belgarath, as the old man entered the tent. Belgarath sprawled in a chair.
Some tantalizing hints was about all. I get the feeling that Anheg's copy of the Ashavin Oracles has been rather carefully pruned somewhere along the way. Or more likely at the very beginning. The modification seemed to be a part of the original text.
Prophets don't usually tamper with their own prophecies, Polgara noted.
This one would have, particularly if parts of the prophecy said things he did not want to believe.
Who was it?
Torak. I recognized his tone and his peculiar turn of phrase almost immediately.
Torak? Geryon exclaimed, feeling a sudden chill. Belgarath nodded.
There is an old Malorian legend that says that after he destroyed Tol Mishrak, Torak had a castle built at Ashaba in the Karandiz Mountains. Once he moved in, an ecstasy came over him, and he composed the Ashabin Oracles. Anyway, the legend goes on to say that after the ecstasy had passed, Torak fell into a great rage. Apparently, there were things in the prophecy that he did not like. That could very well account for the tempering that I detected. We have always been told that the word gives meaning to the event.
Can you do that?
No. But Torak was so arrogant that he may have believed that he could.
But that puts us at a dead end, doesn't it? Geryon asked with a sinking feeling. I mean, the Mrin Codex said that you had to look at all of the mysteries, and if the Ashabin oracles are not correct...
He lifted his hands helplessly.
There is a true copy somewhere,
Belgarath replied confidently.
There has to be. Otherwise the Codex would have given me different instructions.
You're operating on pure faith, Belgarath,
Tenedra accused him.
I know, he admitted. I do that when I don't have anything else to fall back upon.
What did you find at Mar Terran?
Bolgara asked. Belgarath made another vulgar sound.
The monks there may be very good at comforting the spirits of all of those slaughtered marags, but they are very bad at protecting manuscripts. The roof leaks in their library. And the copy of the Malorian Gospels, naturally, was on a shelf right under the leak. It was so soggy that I could barely get the leaves apart, and the ink had run and smeared all over the pages. It was almost totally illegible. I spoke with the monks at some length about that.
He scratched at one bearded cheek.
It looks as if I am going to have to go a bit further afield to get what we need.
You found nothing at all, then?
Belden asked. Belgarath grunted. There was one passage in the oracles that said the Dark God will come again.
Geryon felt a sudden chill gripping his stomach.
Torak? Is that possible?
I suppose you could take it to mean that. But if that is what it really meant, then why would Torak have gone to the trouble of destroying so many of the other passages? If the entire purpose of the oracles was to predict his own return, I expect that he would have been overjoyed to keep them intact.
But you're assuming that old burnt face was rational, Belden growled. I never noticed that quality in him very often.
Oh, no, Belgarath disagreed. Everything Torak did was perfectly rational, as long as you accepted his basic notion that he was the sole reason for creation. No, I think the passage means something else.
Could you read any part of the Malorian Gospels at all, Father?
Just one little fragment. It said something about a choice between the light and the dark.
Belden snorted.
Now, that would be something very unusual. The seers at Kel haven't made a choice about anything since the world was made. They've been sitting on the fence for millennia.
Late the following afternoon, the Sindarian army came into view on the snowy hilltops to the west. Geryon felt a peculiar twinge of pride as the solid, steady men he had always thought of as his countrymen marched purposefully through the snow toward the now doomed city of Rayon. "I might have gotten here sooner," General Brendig apologized as he rode up, "but we had to march around that quagmire where the Drasnian pikemen are bogged down."
"Are they all right?"
Queen Boran asked him quickly. "Perfectly, Your Majesty," the one-armed man replied. "They just can't go anywhere, that's all." "How much rest will your troops need before they will be ready to join the assault, Brendig?" Belgorath asked. Brendig shrugged. "A day ought to do it, Ancient One." "Well, that will give us some time to make our plans," the old man said. "Let's get your men bivouacked and fed, and then Geryon can brief you on the way things stand here." In the strategy meeting in the garishly carpeted main tent that evening, they smoothed out the rough edges of their relatively simple plan of attack. Mandorallan's siege engines would continue to pound the city throughout the next day and on into the following night. On the next morning, a feigned assault would be mounted against the south gate to draw as many cultists as possible away from the hastily erected fortification inside the city. Another force would march out of the secure enclave in the north quarter of Rayon to begin the house-by-house occupation of the buildings facing the perimeter. Yet another force, acting on an inspired notion of General Brendig's, would use scaling ladders as bridges to cross the housetops and drop in behind the newly erected walls inside the city.
"The most important thing is to take Ulfgar alive," Geryon cautioned. "We have to get some answers from him. I need to know just what part he played in the abduction of my son and where Garan is, if he knows. And I want to know just how many of the officers in my army that he has subverted," Queen Poran added.
"It looks as if he is going to be doing a lot of talking," Yarblek said with an evil grin. "In Gorog Nadrak, we have a number of very entertaining ways of loosening people's tongues."
Belgorath told him firmly, "Paul will handle that. She can get the answers we need without resorting to that sort of thing." "Are you getting soft, Belgorath?" Beric asked. "Not likely," the old man replied. "But if Yarblek here gets carried away, it might go a little too far, and you cannot get answers out of a dead man."
"But afterward?" Yarblek asked eagerly.
"I don't really care what you do with him afterward." The next day, Geryon was in a small, curtained-off area in the main tent, going over his maps and his carefully organized lists, trying to determine if there was anything he had overlooked. He had begun of late to feel as if the entire army were resting directly on his shoulders.
"Geryon?"
Tenedra said, entering his cubicle.
"Some friends have arrived."
He looked up.
"Bran's three sons," she told him. "And that glassblower, Joran."
Geryon frowned. "What are they doing here? I told them all to stay at Riva."
"They say that they have got something important to tell you."
He sighed. You'd better have them come in, then." Bran's three gray-cloaked sons and the serious-faced Joran entered and bowed. Their clothes were mud-spattered and their faces weary. Kael assured him quickly,
"We are not deliberately disobeying your orders, Belgarion, but we discovered something very important that you have to know."
"Oh?
What's that?" "After you left Riva with the army, Your Majesty,"
Kael's older brother Verdan explained, "we decided to go over the west coast of the island inch by inch. We thought there might be some clues that we overlooked in our first search."
"Besides," Bren added, "we didn't have anything else to do."
"Anyway," Verdan continued, "we finally found the ship those Kereks had used to come to the island."
"Their ship?"
Geryon asked, suddenly sitting up.
"I thought that whoever it was who abducted my son used it to get off of the island."
Verdan shook his head. "The ship had been deliberately sunk, Your Majesty. They filled it with rocks and then chopped holes in the bottom. We sailed right over it 5 times until a calm day when there wasn't any surf. It was lying on the bottom in about 30 feet of water.
How did the abductor get off of the island, then?
We had that same thought, Belgarian, Joran said. It occurred to us that in spite of everything, the abductor might still be on the Isle of Winds. We started searching, and that's when we found the shepherd.
Shepherd?
He had been alone, with his flock up in the meadow on the western side of the isle, Kale explained. He was completely unaware of what had happened in the city. Anyway, we asked him if he had seen anything unusual at about the time of Prince Garen's abduction, when he was taken from the citadel, and he said that he had seen a ship sailing into a cove on the west coast at about that time, and that somebody carrying something wrapped in a blanket got on board. Then the ship put out to sea, leaving the others behind, Belgarian. It was the same cove where the trail the orb was following ended.
Which way did that ship go?
South.
There's one other thing, Belgarian, Joran added.
The shepherd was positive that the ship was Niasin.
Niasin?
He was absolutely certain. He even described the snake banner she was flying.
Garion got quickly to his feet. Wait here, he told them. Then he went to the flap in the partition.
Grandfather,
Aunt Paul, could you step in here for a moment?
What is it, dear?
Polgara asked, as she and the old sorcerer came into Garion's makeshift office, with Silk trailing curiously behind.
Tell them,
Garion said to Kale. Quickly, Bran's second son repeated what they had just told Garion.
Salmisra?
Polgara suggested to her father.
Not necessarily, Paul. Nyssa is full of intrigue, and the queen is not behind it all. Particularly after what you did to her. He frowned then. Why would a Kerrick abandon one of his own boats to ride aboard a Nyssan scow? Doesn't make any sense.
That is another question that we'll have to ask of Ulfgar, once we get our hands on him, Silk said.
At dawn the next morning, a large body of troops, comprised of elements from all of the forces gathered for the siege, began to march across the valley to the south of the city, toward the steep hill and Rehan. They carried scaling ladders and battering rams in plain sight to make the defenders believe that this was a major assault. In a quarter of the city occupied by Garion's troops, however, Silk led a sizable detachment of men through the dawn murk across the rooftops to clear away the cult archers and the smeared men with their boiling pitch pots occupying those houses on either side of the hastily built walls erected to bar entrance into the rest of the city. Garion, flanked by Beric and Mandorallan, waited in a snowy street near the perimeter of the occupied quarter.
This is the part I hate, he said tensely. The waiting.
I must confess to thee that I myself find this lull just before a battle unpleasant, Mandorallan replied.
I thought Aeron's loved battle, Beric grinned at his friend.
It is our favorite pastime, the great knight admitted, checking one of the buckles under his armor. This interim, just ere we join with the enemy, however, is irksome. Sober, even melancholy thoughts distract the mind from the main purpose at hand.
Mandorallan, Beric laughed, I have missed you.
The shadowy form of Yarblek came up the street to join them. He had put aside his felt overcoat, and now wore a heavy steel breastplate, and carried a wicked-looking axe.
Everything is ready, he told them quietly. We can start just as soon as the little thief gives us the signal.
Are you sure your men can pull down those walls?
Yarblek nodded.
These people didn't have enough time to get the stones and mortar. Our grappling hooks can jerk down the walls in a few minutes.
You seem very fond of that particular tool, Beric observed.
Yarblek shrugged.
I have always found that the best way to get through a wall is to
yank it down.
In Orendia, our preference is the battering ram,
Mandaralan said.
Those are good too,
Yarblek agreed.
But the trouble with a ram is that you are right under the wall when it falls. I have never particularly enjoyed having building stones bouncing off the top of my head.
They waited.
Has anybody seen Laldoran?
Geryon asked.
He went with Silk, Berak replied. He seemed to think that he could find more targets from up on the roof.
He was ever an enthusiast,
Mandaralan smiled.
I must confess, however, that I have never seen his equal with the longbow.
There it is, Berak said,
pointing at a flaming arrow arcing high above the rooftops.
That's the signal.
Geryon drew in a deep breath and squared his shoulders.
All right. Sound your horn, Mandaralan. Let's get started.
The brazen note of Mandaralan's horn shattered the stillness. From every street and alleyway, Geryon's army poured out to begin the final assault on Rehon. Rivens, Algars, Nadrax, and the solid men of Sundaria crunched through the snow toward the perimeter with their weapons in their hands. 30 of Yarblek's leather-clad mercenaries ran on ahead, their grappling hooks swinging from their hands. With Berak at his side, Geryon clambered over the treacherous, sliding rubble of the houses that had been pulled down to form the perimeter, and over the half-dozen bodies of arrow-stitched cultists who had fallen earlier. A few, though not many, cultists had escaped the hasty floor-by-floor search of Silk's men in the houses facing the perimeter, and they desperately showered the advancing troops with arrows. At Brendig's sharp command, detachments of Sindars veered and broke into each house to neutralize those remaining defenders efficiently. The scene beyond the perimeter was one of enormous confusion. Advancing behind a wall of shields, Geryon's army swept the streets clear of the now desperate cultists. The air was thick with arrows and curses, and several houses were already shooting flames out of the roof. True to Yarblek's prediction, the loosely stacked walls blocking the streets some way into the city fell easily to the dozens of grappling hooks that sailed up over their troops and bit into the other side. The grim advance continued, and the air rang with the steely clang of sword against sword. Somehow, in all of the confusion, Geryon became separated from Berak, and found himself fighting shoulder to shoulder beside Durnik in a narrow alleyway. The smith carried no sword or axe, but fought instead with a large, heavy club.
"I just don't like chopping into people," he apologized,
felling a burly opponent with one solid blow.
"If you hit somebody with a club, there's a fair chance that he won't die, and there isn't all that much blood."
They pushed deeper into the city, driving the demoralized inhabitants before them. The sounds of heavy fighting at the southern end of town gave notice that Silk and his men had reached the south wall and opened the gates to admit the massed troops whose feigned attack had fatally divided the cult forces. And then Geryon and Durnik burst out of the narrow alleyway into the broad, snowy central square of Rehon. Fighting raged all over the square, but on the east side, a thick knot of cultists was tightly packed about a high-wheeled cart. Atop the cart stood a black-bearded man in a rust-colored brocade doublet. A lean Nadrak, with a slender spear in his hand, arched back, took aim, and hurled his weapon directly at the man on the cart. The black-bearded man raised one hand in a peculiar gesture, and the Nadrak spear suddenly sheared off to the right, clattering harmlessly on the snow-slick cobblestones. Geryon clearly heard and felt the rushing surge that could only mean one thing.
"Durnik," he shouted, "the man on the cart, that is Ulfgar."
Durnik's eyes narrowed.
"Let's take him, Geryon," he said.
Geryon's anger at this stranger who was the cause of all of this warfare and carnage and destruction suddenly swelled intolerably, and his rage communicated itself to the orb on the pommel of the sword. The orb flared, An Iron Grip's burning sword suddenly flamed out in searing blue fire.
"There, that is the Riven King," the black-bearded man on the cart screamed. "Kill him!"
Momentarily, Geryon's eyes locked on the eyes of the man on the cart. There was hate there. At the same time, an awe and a desperate fear. Blindly obedient to their leader's command, a dozen cultists ran through the slush toward Geryon with their swords aloft. Suddenly, they began to tumble into twitching heaps in the sodden snow in the middle of the square as arrow after arrow laced into their ranks.
"Ho, Geryon!"
Lalderan shouted gleefully from a nearby housetop, his hands blurring as he loosed his arrows at the charging cultists.
"Ho, Lalderan!"
Geryon called his reply, even as he ran in amongst the fur-clad men flailing about him with his burning sword. The attention of the group around the cart was riveted entirely on the horrifying spectacle of the enraged King of Riva and the fabled sword. They did not, therefore, see Durnik the smith moving in a cat-like crouch along the wall of a nearby house. The man on the cart raised one hand aloft, seized a ball of pure fire, and hurled it desperately at Geryon. Geryon flicked the fireball aside with his flaming blade and continued his grim advance, swinging dreadful strokes at the desperate men garbed in bearskins in front of him, without ever taking his eyes off of the pasty-faced man in the black beard. His expression grew panicky. Ulfgar raised his hand again, but suddenly seemed almost to lunge forward off of the cart into the brown slush, as Durnik's cudgel cracked sharply across the back of his head. There was a great cry of chagrin as the cult leader fell. Several of his men tried desperately to lift his inert body, but Durnik's club, whistling and thudding solidly, felled them in their tracks. Others tried to form a wall with their bodies in an effort to keep Geryon from reaching the body lying face down in the snow. But Lalderan's steady rain of arrows melted the center of that fur-clad wall. Geryon, feeling strangely remote and unaffected by the slaughter, marched into the very midst of the disorganized survivors, swinging his huge sword in great sweeping arcs. He barely felt the sickening shear as his sword cut through bone and flesh alike. After he had cut down a half dozen or so, the rest broke and ran.
"Is he still alive?"
Geryon panted at the smith. Durnik rolled the inert Ulfgar over and professionally peeled back one of his eyelids to have a look.
"He's still with us. I hit him rather carefully."
"Good. Let's tie him up. Blindfold him."
"Why blindfold?"
"We both saw him use sorcery, so we have answered that particular question, but I think it might be a little hard to do that sort of thing if you cannot see what you are aiming at."
Durnik thought about that for a moment as he tied the unconscious man's hands.
"You know, I believe you're right. It would be difficult, wouldn't it?"